Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham as we kick off yet another startling week. Nobody knows what's going to happen. Could there be another strike by the RMT? Apparently the guys have gone up to show their solidarity this morning at the Old Bailey with the barristers. I mean, the world has really turned on its head, hasn't it, when barristers and the RMT are standing together arm in arm on the picket line. I think some teachers have popped up as well because, of course, no point going to school anymore because you're not allowed to teach anybody anything interesting. Now, what we're going to do this morning, though, is set out our stall for the week because, as you know, we like to have a sort of a theme. And my theme this week is this. Is there really some kind of crisis of confidence going on? Is there really a situation where people aren't spending any money? Are we just reading about it in newspapers and seeing it on certain television stations where they like to frighten the bejesus out of you? I was out at the weekend in several different places and it was rammed with people. People spending money, people sitting outside eating, drinking, enjoying themselves, people driving around in cars to a very large extent, causing traffic jams all around. And I know we're talking about the southeast of England, not just London, but the southeast of England, Sussex, Kent, all those kind of places, loads of roadworks, loads of people out and about, lots of people spending money that apparently they don't have. So I want to hear from you this morning as to what you're seeing and what you're doing. Also, the airports are rammed with people going on holiday. I thought we didn't have any money. I thought nobody could afford to do anything. I'm slightly puzzled by that. Ben Habib is here. We're going to talk about the G7 meeting currently going on, Boris Johnson's future, such as it is. And also, of course, where we go from here with all manner of things. Peter Hitchens is going to be along to tell us why tribalism is killing British politics and we'll never get anybody worth actually electing unless we change the system. 0344 499 1000 is the number. And of course, the illegal migrant situation. Ben Habib's an expert in that. He'll have some views on it, I'm sure. You're listening to me, Mike Graham, right here on the home of common sense. It is, of course, Talk TV. Welcome to the first of many, the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. We forgot to mention, of course, Wimbledon starts today, so the heat of summer is upon us. Glastonbury was on yesterday and over the weekend. And here, ladies and gentlemen, is the G7 meeting. Now, if you could see it on the front page of the Times, a less diverse group of people, I don't think I could imagine. You've got Charles Michel, President of the European Council, never heard of him. Mario Draghi, Prime Minister of Italy for the next couple of days. Justin Trudeau, the man that doesn't know the truth if it falls on him. He's from Canada. President Macron of France, who just lost 100 seats. Olaf Scholz, the German Chancellor, who likes paying a load of money to the Russians. President Biden, who can't ride a bike without falling off it. Fumio Kishida, the Prime Minister of Japan, don't know, no idea, and Ursula von der Leyen, President of the European Commission, all with Boris Johnson, of course, the man who would rather not ever come back to Britain because everybody hates him. That's a pretty good summation, Ben, of the G7, isn't it?
It is. A middle-aged bunch of, well, I say middle-aged, but actually Trudeau's probably still at school, isn't he?
He looks like he probably should be, yeah. I love that Trudeau has been very, very sure about how women's bodies should not be invaded in any way by politicians, despite the fact that he made sure that everybody in Canada had to have their bodies invaded by politicians.
By the vaccine, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, it's incredible. I don't want to get involved in whether you should or shouldn't be allowed to have an abortion.
Abortion, for me, is not a debate. We're never having it on this show.
Yeah, I don't want to have that debate. No. But the hypocrisy in the debate from Trudeau and people like him is self-evident.
Yes, absolutely extraordinary. So the G7, Boris Johnson starts it off with a little joke about getting your pecs out to sort of beat Vladimir Putin, which seems a bit off-colour.
Does Boris have pecs?
Well, he probably does, but I'm not sure that he doesn't have to keep them in something, you know, in order not to sort of flop about. But, I mean, he is much better on the international stage than he is at home, isn't he? I think we can probably say that.
He is. He is. Well, I mean, Boris is a fantastic campaigner. And when you're abroad, by and large, what you're doing is campaigning.
Yeah.
You know, you're banging the drum for the United Kingdom.
Yeah.
And Ukraine is a perfect drum for him to bang while he's outside the UK, and indeed when he's here, because It gives him that international presence. He can egg President Zelensky on, and actually there's no real risk to him from the electorate in the UK. There's no policy he needs to make that can be shot down. He's done a great job in Ukraine, don't get me wrong, but it's a fantastic distraction from his primary obligation of running the United Kingdom.
But I mean, he has done a great job, but that may well be because everybody else has done such a poor job, because at the beginning, the European Union were nowhere. France and Germany weren't even sure they wanted to get involved. I mean, Germany was promising to send a few hats, many helmets to the Germans. The French still wanted to negotiate with Putin. But the bottom line is that the war's still going on.
It was a low bar.
Yeah, the war's still going on. Ukraine is still a problem. You know, all sorts of things, including car manufacturing, apparently, has been hit by it, because loads of German car companies in particular use Ukraine as a base to produce all sorts of semiconductors and all kinds of other things. So the supply of new cars has apparently been put, there's been massive delay on it. And so all of the kind of, not all of them, but many of the problems that we've got in the cost of living crisis are still being caused by this ongoing war.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, no one knew Ukraine fed 600 million people a year until it was invaded. No one knew about the car manufacturing. Right. No one knew about the importance of its Black Sea ports until they were blocked.
Right.
And, I mean, it says a lot about Ukraine, but it also says about how finely balanced the global economic system is.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've got this cost of living crisis now, and I'm absolutely certain we have that crisis because of lockdown.
You know, for sure, no question.
You know, when we locked down, we threw a massive stone into this sensitive ecosystem that is our global economy.
Yeah.
And it's terribly troublesome coming back from it. If there's any lesson to take away from it, is we must never, ever lock down again.
Yes.
It was a disastrous policy.
And I think as we see more and more of the results of that policy, I think more and more people will not allow themselves to be locked down again. We're getting Molly Kingsley in later on to talk about their new book about, you know, the kids being told they couldn't go to school and being kept away from school, and the ongoing effects that are still affecting many families in this country as a result of that, because kids didn't go to school for the best part of 2 years.
It's going on and on. And you could argue, Mike, quite legitimately, that the war in Ukraine is as a result of lockdown, because it forced oil prices up because reserves were depleted.
Yes.
And with oil prices up, Putin can afford to finance his war. You know, so everything is so finely balanced that when you muck around with it, you set off, you know, it's butterfly wings, isn't it? You set off a sort of tsunami.
And
at
I mean,
the other
isn't it funny? Because Donald Trump, the man that was universally detested by the European Union and most European leaders, got it right. He was the one that said Germany was over dependent on Russia.
He sat in the European Parliament in 2018 and he warned Germany about its increasing reliance on Russian oil.
Yeah.
And the German MEPs laughed at him. He has a funny way of speaking, as we all know.
Yeah.
So he comes across as, you know, perhaps not the sharpest sort of knife in the box. But he was absolutely right.
Yeah,
Germany
but he resonates with ordinary people.
He does.
Which is what Boris Johnson does, funnily enough.
You know, and even now, with everyone fully aware of the importance of, you know, Ukraine being put back on the international trading map, Germany is still buying Russian oil.
Yeah.
You know, it's contributed...
Because they can't stop.
They can't stop. They've contributed 40 billion euros to Putin's coffers. It's massive.
It's incredible. And I was hearing today and over the weekend that they might even have to consider blackouts in Germany in order to sort of somehow ration the gas that they've got, because they want to stop buying it in from Russia. But if they stop immediately, they literally won't have any.
It was an absurd policy of Merkel's to turn her back on nuclear power and to sidle up with Russia.
It's hard to believe, isn't it, that Angela Merkel, only a few short years ago, was considered to be this great visionary who was, you know, not only a brilliant politician, but also trained as a scientist, was brilliant about COVID, knew everything there was to know about integration of Europe. And then she's completely blown everything by her immigrant policy, which destroyed an
awful
lot of countries.
I'm sure facilitated Brexit.
Yes,
absolutely.
And she also facilitated the war in Ukraine, actually, because it was she who first offered Ukraine membership of the EU.
Yeah, and that 10 billion euro loan, which really irritated Putin, because she was trying to pull it into the EU sphere of influence.
So thanks, Angela.
Yeah.
I mean, you've actually completely destroyed Western Europe in a way that nobody could have foreseen, because that brings us nicely to the migrant crisis. We're talking 12,000. I don't think it's anything like that. I think it's probably double that.
Yeah, in terms of numbers. Who knows what the numbers
are. Because there are so many people coming now because they think there might be a time limit on how they can come and when they can come. So they're coming in even bigger numbers, and many of them now are not even bothering with the border force. They're just getting off the boats and walking into Britain.
Yeah, and I mean, as I understand it, actually the French Navy are handing these people over to the British border force in an orderly fashion. Mm. They're being escorted to the end of French territorial waters, and then we're giving them a free taxi ride. So,
well, I watched their videos, I'm sure you did, just last week, of one of these sort of over... supplied dinghies, but I mean they're more than dinghies, they're huge big dirigible boats which are actually quite easy to use and not very dangerous to get into, but they were being helped off those onto a border force boat literally, you know, by hand by border force individuals, and then just brought into Dover.
So if the central foundation of the government's policy is to deter people from coming across, the first thing they've got to do is stop giving them a free taxi service.
Yes.
You know, you can't make the Rwandan policy work. You can't begin to make it work if you're actually facilitating these people coming across our territorial waters. And, you know, one of the problems I have with the whole Rwanda policy is that it is not border control. Mm. The government has sold it as border control, but it isn't.
No.
It's trying to deal with people once they've breached our borders. Mm. It's too late by then. Then you've got the British judicial system against you, the European Court of Human Rights against you, you've got the cost of doing it against you, and then you've got all the optics of no doubt the inevitable human rights abuses that will be claimed to take place in Rwanda once you get a deportee there. So massive hurdles after you've helped these people actually cross the channel in the first place.
Yes. Well, that's the thing. I mean, if you are technically allowing them to board a border force vessel and you are then bringing them into port, you're in some way kind of part of the problem, aren't you?
You're part of the problem.
Assisting them to break the law.
So I had this brilliant idea, which I tweeted and got dumped on. Did you see my tweet?
Yes, I saw yours. Yeah, yeah. Well, I think I heard you on Jeremy's show talking about the boats, like registered boats from Rwanda.
Yeah, so the reason Border Force apparently won't push these dinghies back into French water is because all the illegal migrants would join. There's a risk that they would jump into the sea, and then they'd have to be rescued. And once they're rescued, they're on British. They benefit from British protection on British boats.
Yeah.
So why not have Border Force backed up by Rwandan boats?
Yes.
And if people wish to jump off their dinghies, they get rescued by Rwandan boats.
Yes.
Which in our territorial waters, on the boat themselves, are still subject to Rwandan law.
And people were ridiculing the idea because Rwanda doesn't have a coastline. Well, it doesn't mean they can't have boats, does it?
Yeah, no, you don't need a coastline to own a boat.
No.
And you don't need to have a direct line back to Rwanda. You could take them via Yemen, a country, for example, that isn't a member of the European Convention of Human Rights, and fly them in from Yemen, or you could take them on Mombasa and put them on a train, or whatever you want to do.
Right.
The point is, don't give them the protection of British law at the taxpayer's expense.
No, I think that is absolutely the way forward. We'll talk about the taxpayer's expense coming up. Ben Habib is here. We want to take your calls as well, because I'm asking the question for you. What exactly is going on out there? Benedict says this. Mike, I think it depends very much where you are. There's a lot of overhype in the media. It's almost like we are talking ourselves into recession. In Wigan, I'm noticing that pubs, restaurants and the town centre are quieter than normal, even at weekends. Well, what's it like where you are? Are shops actually closing down? Are people not going out? Because it's not like that in the south of the country, as far as I can tell, from a very limited show over the weekend. But I'm interested in this, so I want to hear from you. 0344 499 1000. This is Talk TV.
Talk Radio.
Danger. Slippery people.
Uncomplicated life rubric for hungry thought thinkers. It's Talk Radio.
The home of common sense.
Nationwide, by your side, Talk Radio and Talk TV.
Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk TV. The first show of the week. There's loads going on. There's a G7 meeting. There's going to be a NATO meeting in Madrid, I think, tomorrow, at which they're going to try and talk Turkey into letting some Scandinavian countries in. It's all kind of a bit macroeconomic for me. We're going to talk now about what I found to be the most extraordinary story of the weekend. Ben Habib is here. Prince of Wales accepting €3 million, that's £2.5 million in cash payments, including one suitcase which contained €1 million in notes. I mean, people walking around London with that kind of money from Qatar may be more sort of regular than we know, but it doesn't sound right to me.
Well, it isn't right, is it? I mean, you know, the reason people pay in cash is because they want to avoid being able to be audited.
Right.
So you can't see where the money has come from. Mm. And for the Prince's office to instantly declare that all checks were made just doesn't ring true. It cannot be true.
No.
Because the point is, you can't trace where cash came from. If it came through the banking system, you'd be able to know that this was legitimate or illegitimate, depending on where it came from. But cash, by definition, can't be traced back. And therefore, it is a deeply dodgy way to communicate.
Well, it reminds me of, I mean, when I read the story, it reminded me of that scene in Godfather 2 when Fredo's flying with the suitcase full of money to Cuba to hand it over to Hyman Roth. To start the casino business. And he's going, you know, I was sitting with $1 million in my seat. I couldn't deal with it, you know. And that's the kind of thing we're talking about. Somebody's put it on a plane, right? Presumably carried it from Qatar, because the guy who had it was a former prime minister, I believe. And handed, I mean, who in their right mind, eating, forget whether you're the heir to the throne, but who in their, I mean, if I was sitting in the Dorchester Hotel and the guy handed me a suitcase with €1 million in it, I'd be thinking,
yeah, what is
this
going
doesn't
on?
Seem right.
No, quite.
Really.
Yeah, you'd be very concerned about it.
Yeah.
And it is a breaking of law. You know, if you're suspicious of where the money came from, you are potentially liable. So I think the prince has been a bit...
He's been naive at best, hasn't he?
At the very least, he's been naive.
It really is very, very strange. But what? Let's go back to Rwanda briefly, because there is this sort of, you know, establishment way of thinking, isn't there? Where you've got people who, like everyone that goes to Glastonbury, for example. I think you could probably encapsulate all of the people at Glastonbury, and you would not find anyone there that voted for Brexit. You would not find anyone there that thinks the Rwanda plan's a good idea. You know, you would not find anyone there that doesn't support Zelensky. You know what I mean? There's just this kind of group thing.
The liberal
now.
Elite.
Yeah, the liberal elite. And, you know, I mean, one thing Lenny Henry was right about is that it is an incredibly white event. You know, you don't really see anybody there who isn't from West London, you know, from Putney or Richmond or something. And Prince Charles is part of that. You know, he goes out and goes, well, this is an appalling thing to do. It's clearly not an appalling thing to do because, as I've said many times before, people who complain that you're sending people thousands of miles to a place they've never been, well, that's how they got here.
Well, by definition, it can't be appalling because effectively what the British government is saying is you've got a choice between staying in France or going to Rwanda. So they've got freedom of choice, if you like. You know, if they don't want to go to Rwanda, stay in France. But my problem with the Rwanda thing, as you know, Mike, is that I think it was all optics. It was designed to fail.
Mm.
It was designed to make it look like the government was doing something.
Yes, and they were going to be prevented from doing it.
And then they would be prevented, and then they could have all this thing about the European Convention of Human Rights, which we're now having, the European Court of Justice, and, you know, this notion that we can leave the ECHR. But, of course, we can't leave the ECHR. Everyone out there needs to listen to what I'm about to say.
Okay.
We cannot leave the European Convention of Human Rights.
Why not?
Because we have signed up to it as a commitment in the Trade and Cooperation Agreement, and it is embedded in the Belfast Good Friday Agreement. So we would have to break two international treaties.
But surely if we rip up the Northern Ireland Protocol, or Article 16 in the Northern Ireland Protocol, that also is in breach of the Good Friday Agreement, isn't it?
No, it isn't. The protocol breaches the Good Friday Agreement.
Yeah.
The protocol is a fundamental breach of that agreement because it foisted a new constitutional setup on Northern Ireland without cross-community consent, without any form of
consent. So they've already done that then?
I mean, the protocol is a fundamental... So I take the point you're making. Mm. And of course you can break international treaties. You know, treaties are not set in stone for a country to abide by in perpetuity.
Yeah, exactly.
They have to change when a country's needs change. And I wish the government had the courage to tear up both the Trade and Cooperation Agreement and the protocol. Let's do it.
Yes.
Let's get on with it. You know, what are the EU going to do? They talk about a trade war. If they were going to have a trade war, Mike, they'd have to put a hard border on the island of Ireland.
Yes.
They would have to come forward and demonstrably do the opposite of what they've been saying is intolerable.
Yeah.
You know, they would have to actually do the intolerable.
Right.
You know, they've been telling us we can't have customs checks.
Well, that's the thing. And I mean, what we seem to have here with this particular government, and I don't say just Boris Johnson, I say the government, is that they move from one sort of stone to another, but they never get to the other side of the river. You know, we've got now, for example, on the front page of the Telegraph, Biden to block PM's answers to the food crisis because he's now moved on to, oh, let's forget about the wilding mandate and let's grow more of our own food.
But
you still haven't solved the fuel crisis. You still haven't given anybody any money back. I mean, they talk about giving pensioners 10%. They talk about handing out money to people who are less well off and, you know, giving them council tax rebates. But that's not making any difference to people, is it?
No. And let's talk about that for a second. I want to go back to Rwanda and Northern Ireland, but let's talk about the handout of money. He had a choice between slashing fuel duty, slashing VAT, which are tax cuts, which this nation desperately needs, which is traditional conservative ideology, and actually giving people money.
Mm.
And he went for giving people money.
Which is a mistake, surely.
It is a mistake. It's that inbred tax, borrow and spend mentality, which has gripped the modern Conservative Party. And it's got to break away from it. It's got to understand that people must be given the freedom of choice of how they spend their money.
Yeah.
By, and they must have money put in their back pockets by cutting taxes. If they don't want RMT out striking, if they don't want British Airways, the NHS, teachers and now the barristers, everyone out striking, what they should do is reduce taxes. It's the you don't solve the cost of living crisis and the inflationary impacts of that by increasing wages. You do it by cutting costs.
Right.
And the sharpest and quickest way to cut costs is by cutting taxes.
And by cutting fuel costs momentarily, because, I mean, that is literally fueling everything else. I mean, the barristers, apparently, I was listening to an interview this morning, are actually rejecting a 15% pay rise. 15% apparently is not good enough for them.
Well, you know, I haven't looked at the trajectory of their wages or earnings over the last 12 years.
But they're claiming that they're down about 20-odd%.
Yeah.
But even so.
But even, Mike, they might be. You know, when you look at the performance of the British economy over the Tory government since 2010, it is dire.
Yeah.
You know, we've had GDP go from 2 trillion in 2010 to 2.2 trillion now.
Mm.
Meantime, the US has grown by 50%.
Right.
If you look at public sector wages in this country, they've gone up by 5% on average since 2010.
Yeah.
Inflation in that period, excluding the current spike, has been about 25%.
Right.
So you've had net real loss in net wages of 20% over a 12-year Tory government. People are going to
eventually where's all the money gone? Where has all the money that they've collected in taxes gone? I believe it to have gone to ridiculously kind of overfilled civil service jobs, ludicrous amounts going to the NHS, which is clearly about as inefficient as you can
and
get.
And a lot of it wasted. And we're about to
And wasting the rest, as the George Best joke used to say.
And £1.4 trillion we're now committing to the net zero agenda.
Surely to golly, he's got to jump off that at some point. But it doesn't seem like he's ever going to.
And that too is baked into the Trade and Cooperation Agreement, where we cannot regress from our commitment to net zero by 2050. The 1.4 trillion, let's just think about that number for a second. I know when you bandy about big numbers, it's hard to get them into your head.
Several holdalls full of Qatari cash.
Yeah, that'll do Prince Charles handsomely.
Yeah.
No, that is the equivalent, virtually the equivalent of all corporation tax take by the government every year between now and 2050.
Yeah.
The burden on the economy is massive. Put another way, it represents 70% of our national debt.
Mm.
How can the nation afford that when we've already got this cost of living crisis? And make no mistake, that 1.4 trillion burden will fall squarely on the shoulders of the working and middle classes.
Yeah.
It's them who'll pay the price. It won't be the rich. The rich can afford to get new forms of heating for their house.
Yes.
The rich can afford higher fuel taxes. The rich can afford a brand new Tesla.
Yeah.
It's not going to hit them. It's going to hit the working and middle classes. The very people that Boris Johnson keeps saying he wants to level up. Well, you do not level up by instituting a policy that levels down their wealth. It just doesn't make any sense at all.
It doesn't make any sense at all. Ben Habib, thank you very much indeed. Fascinating stuff. Very, very highbrow here at Talk TV this morning. We don't normally do that, but we did it for you today just to show you how good we are. This is Talk TV. Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk TV with you all the way through until 1 o'clock. Ian Collins will be here. Jeremy Kyle will be here. Of course, we've got an entire panoply of shows coming up this evening as well. Tom Newton Dunn with the news desk. Piers Morgan from 8 o'clock. We've got the talk from 9 o'clock. I'm on that a little bit later on in the week, Wednesday, Thursday and Friday to be precise. But what about the big story of yesterday? Sunday Times splashed with their story. An extraordinary story, really, when you think about it, about Prince Charles, the heir to the throne, the man who literally been out in Rwanda waving the flag for Britain because he's about to be probably the man that steps into the fray when the Queen decides that, you know, she can no longer really fulfill all of her duties. What we've got is the heir to the throne being given millions and millions of pounds from a sheikh in Qatar, right? The former Prime Minister, I believe he is. Not least in some bags from Fortnum and Mason, and not least in a holdall. €1 million alone in a holdall. Somebody was asking me this morning, how big is that? And I was actually thinking, you can actually get €1 million if you've got 500 euro notes. It's not that many little packages of money. We've all seen the the various shows and movies where they smuggle money around and cash, and you can actually have $1 million probably in an attaché case. But let's talk to Alan Mendoza, Executive Director at the Henry Jackson Society, because charity commission people are now saying they're going to have a look into this to see what is actually going on. But Alan, very good morning to you. It's
good
a
morning,
very
Mike.
Strange way to be doing business, isn't it?
It's utterly bizarre. I mean, the idea that millions of euros are being carted around in cash around London, being handed over personally to the principal of a charity, is just extraordinary to sort of contemplate what's gone on here. And it, you know, obviously raises all kinds of questions about charity governance, about the nature of the donation, about the donor. So much revealed by this story. And it's just incorrect to say that it's an irrelevancy because it happened years ago.
Yeah.
We need to, you know, understand exactly how this donation came about. Why was it paid in such an unusual way? Surely he had money, by the way, he could wire in somewhere. It makes no sense, this story, at all.
Well, as Ben Habib just said to me, the only reason you would hand over that kind of amount of money in cash is to make sure that it wasn't traced by anybody who wanted to tax it or to ask a question of where it had come from.
Yeah, I mean, it's bizarre from that perspective. Look, the Sheikh is fairly controversial. He's been named, obviously, in the Panama Papers, the Pandora Papers. We know all about, you know, the inferences of that. But it does seem strange that the heir to the throne here, who obviously is heavily involved with numerous of his own charities, would think this was a sensible way to accept money from anyone, let alone someone from a foreign country.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm sort of reminded of that session in, I think it was Zurich, wasn't it, when they decided to award the World Cup first to Russia and then to Qatar, and all those Qatari gentlemen jumped up punching the air. And I have to feel now whether or not there were sacks of holdalls full of euros going around there.
Well, there's long been the suggestion this was not a fair process. If you speak to those involved in the various bids to discover exactly what happened, they will give you chapter and verse on what they say happened. And clearly, Qatar was a most unusual choice for a World Cup, as is evidenced by the fact we're holding it in winter rather than summer, because, of course, it's just impossible to hold it at the usual time. And that's not, of course, to mention Qatar's lack of football prowess.
And well, not only lack of football prowess, but rather unusual kind of views on lots of other things as well. Not least, you've got the problem of their reaction to gay marriage and to even being gay. It's apparently illegal in Qatar. We're told it's going to be a very diverse and inclusive World Cup, but I'm not quite sure how that's going to work. They've also been responsible for the deaths of dozens and dozens, if not thousands, of migrant workers who have come in to help build the stadiums. You know, and they've also got a massive grip, have they not, into London's property market?
Yes, in fact, the Sheikh was responsible for much of that. He was in charge of the Sovereign Wealth Fund, basically, that bought up large swathes of London in the first decade of this century. Mm. So they've got that clear sort of influence there. And you're quite right to point out there are significant human rights concerns around this World Cup, around the country itself, its treatment of migrant workers, how it treats minorities. And of course, it's frankly, dodgy foreign policy views as well, where Qatar has, of course, backed the al-Nusra Front, the al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria in the past. It's meddled in the Palestinian conflict. This is not a particularly, kind of friendly country, even if we count it, as a somewhat lukewarm ally.
Yes. And I mean, it's the one place, is it not, on the sort of in the Gulf, which is looked upon rather suspiciously by Saudi Arabia, because they see Qatar as a sort of, ally of the Iranians, ally of the people that don't particularly get along with the Saudis. And it's all a bit complex, I know, to cover in 5 minutes. But I mean, they're not the world's, they're not even the Middle East's favourite country.
No, not at all. Though it's kind of difficult to work out who is the Middle East's favourite country. But on the note, you're quite right. Qatar has allied itself to some of the worst regimes in the Middle East, and it's attempted in various parts to throw its wealth around through its control of Al Jazeera, of course, which is notable for not criticising Qatar itself, but criticising everyone else in the region, despite there being plenty to criticise in Qatar, and the relationships with Iran, the relationships with Turkey, the relationships with various terrorist groups. This is not a country who has, as I said, endeared itself to us in recent years or to its neighbours.
No.
And that's caused diplomatic chaos.
No, I mean, they're in the Shard as well, I think, I'm right in saying, amongst other places that they...
Because
I think
that's correct, yes.
Al Jazeera's office, I think, in London is still in the Shard. So it's a remarkable thing. But does this also point to what we all suspect as well, Alan, that there are, in various shapes and forms, large amounts of money being shipped in and out of London, often in cash, often in suitcases, often from places where they'd rather you didn't ask where it came from?
Well, this has been a constant theme, hasn't it, in recent weeks, as we were discovering, for example, the flow of Russian money into the country, how this has been operating. Now we're seeing the flow of Middle Eastern money, how this can sometimes be operating. There are grave concerns about how London's become, if you like, a soft touch for this kind of activity. Now, you know, we hasten to add that we obviously don't know the provenance of this donation. There is no immediate suggestion that anything's, you know, been done wrong in terms of where the money's come from. In fact, the Prince's charities have said they vetted it and there was nothing wrong with it. So, you know, that's something that'll have to be investigated clearly by the charity
regulator. Well, I mean, I suppose they would say that, wouldn't they?
Well, they would, but I look, let's put it this way. If you get a million, you know, euro donation in cash, you better be damn sure where it comes from if you're a registered charity in this country, because of course it is a charitable, it's a charity commission thing to look at straight away. So one would assume, I'm going to assume that there is, you know, some validity. They did check the donation out. They were able to work out where it exactly hailed from and why it was being delivered in cash. That'll no doubt come out in this investigation. But it's an unusual thing to have happened, that's for sure. It's not something that's recommended practice for any charity, and it seems particularly odd given the method of transfer from one, if you like, leader to another.
Well, it also makes you wonder a little bit, does it not, about the sort of the virtue signalling that goes on in this country from various groups of people who are quite happy to accept money from a place like Qatar?
Well, yes, quite right. It's obviously, as we've discussed, it's obviously a country where there are grave concerns about aspects of human rights, about its foreign policy, about its true nature of what it's trying to do, and whether those are in, if you like, the UK's best interests. And yet we're seeing, you know, large transfers of money in this way coming in. I think, you know, the time is ripe, frankly, for some kind of law to examine how, you know, anyone receives money from, particularly charities receive money from certain, you know, kind of autocratic places outside of the UK. We need to look at this carefully and work out what is going on in the money trail.
And on the basis that there's no such thing as a free lunch, I imagine there's no such thing as a million euros in a hold all either. I mean, presumably you want something in return for that, don't you?
Well, there are many reasons why people, you know, donate charities. I'm not going to speculate as to what might have been the reason. You know, it might simply have been recognition of doing a good thing. I mean, let's be frank about this. The Prince's charities do some very good work, obviously. And it may simply be a way of going, right, I'm supporting one of your things. And, you know, maybe down the line you'll support one of my things. I mean, there's that sort of, you know, inference always, isn't there, in such large donations.
Well, I think that's the trouble, isn't it? Listen, good to talk to you, Alan. Thank you very much indeed. Alan Mendoza, the Executive Director of the Henry Jackson Society. I'd have to say, with all due respect to Prince Charles, the heir to the throne, I don't think I'd be accepting a million euros in a hold-all in a hotel lobby from somebody from Qatar without realising what was going on. Would you? This is Talk TV.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Peter Hitchens, a very good morning to you.
Good morning to you too.
I hope you don't mind me referring to you as a pessimist.
Not at all. I know the world's greatest pessimist.
I know you revel in the idea.
Well, it's the key to happiness. I don't know how you optimists manage to get from one day's end to the next.
It is extraordinary. Occasionally I do. I had a very odd thing, not an odd thing, but one of those things that happens from time to time. I couldn't find my car keys anywhere. Yes. And I'm sure that they're somewhere, but I just don't know where. Fortunately, I had a spare set.
Yes.
But I didn't know if they would work, but they did work. But it's this kind of nagging...
The thing to do is to buy some expensive replacement car keys, and then you will find the old one.
Yes, that's a very good idea.
Whenever I lose a book,
after
a few days of searching hopelessly, I buy a replacement copy, and then the old one
I'm slightly...
Where it wasn't before.
Yeah, I'm slightly... Because I'm convinced that I've thrown things out without knowing, and I've got a feeling I may have thrown them out.
Yeah.
You know, when you kind of... When the days when I used to smoke...
Well, this is the onset of doom, anyway.
I think it is. It's the onset of some kind of dementia. But there was a time, when I was younger, when I used to smoke. I'm pretty sure I've thrown ashtrays away. Just instead of emptying them, you just put the whole thing in the bin, and then you empty the bin.
Yes. Had you been doing anything else apart from smoking at the time?
You can be distracted.
Yeah.
You know when you're distracted?
Yeah.
And this is how I lost one of my briefcases. And I'm pretty sure I put it down next to the car, got in the car and drove the car away without putting it in the car.
Okay, the other good thing is putting it on top of the car and then driving
that
away.
Yeah, my father did that once with an AA book when we were off to Europe on a summer holiday. And we got to Dover and realised we didn't have the AA book. Wow. And in those days, there was no sat-nav, there was no way of buying any other kind of atlas.
Yeah.
So we just had to drive around Europe without any kind of map at all.
Well, we're all very lucky that we got back.
Luckily, he'd been in the RAF, so he'd started using the stars. But he was a bit...
So you got a Hamburg, all right.
He was a bit eccentric, yeah. anyway, that's a long story. But let's talk about the tribalism that you wrote about the weekend.
Yes.
Because two big by-elections, neither of which really resulted in anything other than what you thought would happen.
Well, I used to spend a large part of my life reporting on by-elections, from Bermondsey to Darlington to Chesterfield, when they were thought to be big news. This is when the party system seemed to be about to shift, when the Social Democrats, you remember David Owen, Shirley,
yes, Williams, the Gang of Four,
and Bill Rogers all got together. There really did seem to be a genuine move away from Labour, and it was therefore quite exciting in its way. But the funny thing was how the political party system got together and squeezed it out.
Yeah,
I mean, Margaret Thatcher saved the Labour Party, something that is still not widely enough known.
Right.
She, in the Tory manifesto of, I think, 87, there was a proposal which would have deprived the Labour Party of trade union funds. It would have forced the unions to require people to opt into to giving to the Labour Party. And the Labour Party General Secretary at the time went to her and said, if you do this, then what you will do is you will almost certainly destroy the Labour Party. Uh-huh. And what will happen is then you will be thrown out of office by the Social Democrats.
Yeah.
But if by any chance it doesn't work out like that and we ever get into power again, we will do the same to you. We will make it impossible for you ever to raise funds from business again.
Right.
So she gave up.
Right.
And that was the moment at which the Labour Party was saved and Blairism became a possibility. If she hadn't done that, we could have genuinely had a revolution in British politics in the 80s and 90s, which might have changed things very substantially.
It might well have done, because of course, ironically, when Blair became the leader of the Labour Party, that was the beginning of the end of the trade unions having as much influence as they used to have.
But part of the reason they lost influence was they were so much smaller, and they were so much smaller because the industries in which they existed had by and large disappeared.
Mm.
And then obviously there was the long period of Lord Levy, Lord Cashpoint, as he's known, raising non-trade union money for Labour. And I noted the other day that he was back in business.
Well, do you know, funnily enough, by complete coincidence, I saw him last week because I was in the House of Lords, having lunch with Claire Fox. And as we were finding our way out through some internecine way, that was the only way she knew.
It's a building site now, isn't it?
Well, yeah, so there was a load of people sort of being led in to be shown around, and he had about five or six people with him. Mm. And I suddenly thought, oh, I hadn't seen him for a while.
He's back, he's definitely, which is interesting.
Yeah.
It's a sign that the Blairites have decided to put all their muscle behind Keir Starmer.
Mm.
Which could make a difference.
Well, it could, but except Keir Starmer seems to be sort of slightly losing his authority.
Well, you can put all your muscle behind a good candidate, and you can put all your muscle behind an indifferent candidate. Mm. And of course, if it's a good candidate, it'll work.
Because it still seems very confused in the Labour Party. We saw Diane Abbott at the weekend shouting from the rooftops about the strike and why she was in support of it. And then we saw David Lammy yesterday saying that it was wrong to strike, and you're kind of going, well, where are you exactly?
Well, they're nowhere, and this is the whole problem with them. It has been so for a long time. I mean, Labour is in a very, very serious case, and Labour was probably more badly damaged than anybody else by the referendum.
Mm.
Because what happened at the referendum, we've talked about Gillian Duffy, the woman Gordon Brown called a bigot.
Yes.
She symbolised a type of Labour voter, very much, you know, pro-trade union, pro-welfare state, very, very much old-fashioned 1945 Labour people, but not really all that keen on mass immigration.
No.
And they voted Labour loyally.
And many working-class people feel that way.
Exactly. They voted Labour loyally for decades.
Yeah.
And the fascinating thing about the Leave campaign, it was those voters who actually delivered the Leave majority. It was I realised what was going to happen quite about halfway through the referendum campaign when a bus driver said to me, "Everybody at my bus depot is going to vote to Leave," and I thought this.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years, like a chatbot maybe your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at UH1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Happened,
yeah,
and from then on, I was certain that Leave would win. It was a huge internal Labour Party revolt, and a lot of those people have never quite got decided to go back.
No,
but they'd be much keener on trade unions, for instance, than the Islington intellectual.
Yes, and that's why they've got it so wrong. It seems to me that the Labour Party have lost their way because they don't any longer have a core sort of support. Because the people who actually believe the things that they hate were their core support, but aren't anymore.
Well, to a great extent. I don't think the Labour Party could get a national majority again. Of course, the other thing is they've been massacred in Scotland.
Yes,
have the Tories, and that's made a huge difference. But the Tories have a similar problem.
Mm.
I mean, for many, many years, their local associations have been dying out. They have real problems in by-elections getting anybody to do all the leafleting and knocking on doors that's necessary, because there's nobody there anymore. And the party is empty. And it's perfectly obvious to anybody who looks at it that it's not a remotely conservative party. So, and yet they still vote for it.
Mm.
And people say to me, well, why don't you stand for Parliament? I say, well, because you wouldn't vote for me.
Right.
There is no instance of a genuinely independent candidate winning a seat at a general election.
Mm.
And people say, well, what about Martin Bell? I said, Martin Bell won in that. You remember that?
He was the anti-Sleaze candidate.
Well, yes, but he also, the Labour Party and the Liberal Democrats withdrew on his behalf. Mm. I promise you, and I'm absolutely, totally confident of this, if I stood for Parliament, the Labour Party and the Liberal Democrats would not withdraw to make way for me.
It's
not going to happen. So and people would then, general election time comes, by elections they have a sort of holiday, but general election time comes, they go back into tribal.
And I mean, you know, and also if you did win and you were the sole independent in the Parliament, you would have literally no power. There's nothing you can do. I interviewed Bernie Sanders years ago when I worked in America when he was running to be the first independent senator for Vermont, and he won, and he got into the Senate in Washington D.C. and he managed to do absolutely nothing in the years that he worked there. And you know, he ran for president and all of that, but as an independent with some rather unusual views, he couldn't get anything done.
No, all parliaments and senates are all about making deals with the others, and that's why political parties exist and always will exist. The problem with this country is it has two dead political parties, Labour and the Tories, which are kept alive by state funding. There's a lot more state funding parties in opposition than people realise, and by dodgy billionaires. And if either of them were forced to rely on going out in the streets and rattling tins, nobody would give them anything.
Yeah.
But because of these, and also because of the broadcasting rules, which oblige the BBC to give huge coverage to existing parties and don't give them any real incentive to give new up-and-coming parties a fair crack, the system is frozen, and it's very hard to shift it. But if we could have two parties, I've said always basically a Daily Mail party and a Guardian party, in which all the real issues which divide people came up, I think it would transform our politics.
Well, there's certainly no doubt the Tory party, as it is now run by Boris Johnson, is not at all conservative. And many people now tell me that they're never going to vote conservative again on the basis of that.
They say that now. But you see, when it comes to it, are they going to vote for a Keir Starmer party?
No.
Or let a Keir Starmer party?
Will they vote Lib Dem, though?
Well, possibly. But then again, the Lib Dems are pretty plainly operating in an unstated alliance. I mean, look, look at the Labour vote in the Tiverton-Honiton by-election. It collapsed almost to nothing. Now,
why
was that?
Well, we're told it was tactical voting.
Well, yes, but no one's ever going to admit to it, are they? Because it's dangerous to admit to it. But people are going to spot that the Lib Dems are pretty much holding hands with Keir Starmer. And the other thing that Keir Starmer's never really been questioned about is, what is his attitude towards the Scottish Nationalists? If he gets enough seats in England to form an alliance with the Scottish Nationalists,
would he do it?
Westminster majority. Well, he doesn't need to do anything formal, but would he work with them? And how much is he prepared to give them to get it?
Well, quite.
But he won't say this. I bet he doesn't say this before the election. But people will suspect, won't they, that a Labour victory, whatever form it takes, will mean the breakup of the union.
Yes, and if they are, as we believe, you know, determined to get the Tories out, if that's the only way they can do it, then surely that's what they will do.
Well, then what would be the point of getting the Tories out if by doing so you actually give the left many of the things it's always wanted.
Yes, no, I agree.
It doesn't make sense. And it's what the great pity is that we didn't sort this out back in a dozen years ago.
Yeah.
When the Tory party could easily have been chucked in the bin and carted away to landfill,
yes,
and replaced with something better.
But crimes against conservatism.
Much, much harder now.
Exactly right. Peter Hitchens is here. We're talking about a great many things. We'll be doing more. We'll take more of your calls as well, coming up shortly after this on Talk TV.
Nationwide, by your side, Talk Radio and Talk TV.
Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk TV. Peter Hitchens is here with me. You were writing about this tribalism at the weekend, but you mentioned this amazing sort of plot, which I suppose for those of us who are interested in politics, you think is going on all the time, because I won't say who I get them from, but I get a lot of messages from Tory MPs who are attempting to either, one, influence me, or two, tell me things that are going on behind the scenes in the Tory party in Westminster. And how unpopular Boris Johnson is, and how, you know, it's only a matter of time. And this sort of relentless plotting goes on.
What else have they got to do? The Boris? I mean, they're underoccupied people, I think.
Yes, I think so.
And there's a lot of stuff just sitting on committees, voting the way the whips tell them to do half the time, or answering letters about people.
But there must be like more failed plots in politics than any other line of work.
This one was a very narrow thing. It was a by-election in Darlington where the Labour candidate was expected to lose. And I use expected probably in both senses of the word. I don't think he knew he was expected to lose, but everybody else did.
Yeah.
And then he won.
Right.
And if he'd lost, then there would have been this great putsch against poor dear old Michael Foot, who was then the Labour leader. You've been heaved out by the brutal figure of Dennis Healey.
Yes.
And imagine an election
campaign. Healey would have been good, wouldn't he?
Imagine an election campaign with Margaret Thatcher on one side and Dennis Healey on the other. It would certainly have been fun.
Yeah.
And it would have been a lot closer than that 1980.
Your Foot was a sort of pathetic character in the end. I mean, he wasn't a bad guy, but
he wasn't a bad guy. And he but by then he was all that doddering and was the result of a very bad car crash.
Yes. I used to see him on Hampstead Heath regularly because I used to live up there, and you know he genuinely couldn't walk very well.
No, he was a personally kind and intelligent person, but he could never really. It was an act of extraordinary folly to imagine they could ever have won an election with him as leader. But that was the last chance.
But I suppose
if that by-election had gone the other way, then we would have seen a wholly different political scene in this country.
But then, because had that happened, perhaps you'd never have seen the rise of Kinnock and Blair and all that crowd.
A lot of things would not have happened. But here's the thing. That's an unusually important result of a by-election.
Yes.
Which in fact didn't happen. Mm. Most by-elections tell you almost nothing about what will happen at the next general election.
Well, I don't think you can draw any conclusions from either of those results, really. I mean, it means absolutely nothing.
No, and everybody now is saying, well, no, Johnson must go. Well, okay, but the question which then comes back to all of the Tories who say Johnson must go is, all right, who have you got?
And they haven't got anyone.
What have they got?
But that's the thing. But also, after a while, you keep saying the same thing over and over again with the same result, i.e. he doesn't go, then he's never going, is he?
I mean, there is always the possibility that he loses a general election and goes then. But will he or won't he? Everybody thought John Major would lose the 1992 general election.
I remember, including John Major.
Yeah, and with reason.
Yes.
But I know it didn't happen.
No.
So who knows? I don't know. It's not my business. It's an intrusion into private grief for me.
Find ourselves in the midst of. I mean, more and more whenever you come in here, it's more ridiculous. It seems to me the G7 summit looks like just some kind of overprivileged boys' club where they just stand around trying to look good in pictures and basically say nothing of any merit at all.
The word is boondoggle.
Yes,
it's just an occasion where they all browse and sluice together at our expense, and I suppose there may be some advantage in having met each other personally, but that's about it. But it gives the people who report on that kind of thing something to do, doesn't it?
And I heard Ursula von der Leyen last night on some radio station I was listening to talking about how they're going to give a load of money now to developing countries in order to stop the influence of China. And you go, well, one, you haven't got any money, and two, exactly how are you going to make that happen?
Yes, it is interesting, isn't it? Especially given the Chinese are much better at doling out money than we are.
Well, what they do is they build infrastructure with their money.
But no, they aren't particularly fussy about it. They don't demand commitments to to democracy and justice and freedom or anything like that.
They just give them a load of money.
Find the kind of people who are going to take money from them and give it to them. And then, a few years later, they discover what the conditions are and they find out that China is permanently squatting on their society. As I went to Africa and went around a bit of this. It's astonishingly clever the way they do it, and people don't realise just how much their countries are being bought.
Yes. I'm told there's a Pacific island, and I can't tell you the name because I don't remember it, but somewhere sort of in the South Pacific where they went to suggest that they could help with tourism for that island, and they've now ended up basically building a military base where a lot of their ships go. So it was meant to be for cruise ships, but in the end that didn't work out terribly well. But they built this whole sort of docking area, which is now a stopping off point for the Chinese Navy.
They're quite good at building almost entirely new islands in that part of the world.
Yeah, yeah.
It'll be very handy when they're huge, great aircraft carriers, which they're now building, get going.
But they're
very determined. If anybody else was doing it, it would be called imperialism.
Yes, but it's not.
Chinese do, I know, do it, it's they extraordinary. Get away with it.
Now, I said at the beginning of this show that I wasn't going to do the abortion debate because I don't know that I want to, but you want to have something to say about
it? Well, yes, I had a certain amount of how should I put it?
Vitriol?
No, back and forth this weekend, because I decided that I often get people on Twitter saying their basic line of attack when I say anything like this, oh, why did the wrong brother die, about my late brother Christopher?
Which is particularly unpleasant, isn't it?
They say it all the time. I mean, it's an illustration how feeble their arguments are. And it was partly in the back of my mind when the abortion thing came out. Well, I will get out an article, it's actually an interview, that my brother gave I must be more than a dozen years ago now, obviously, about abortion, in which he said, I'm against it. And gives perfectly good left-wing reasons for being against abortion. Now, you don't hear this very often. There was a very, very articulate American libertarian leftist called Nat Hentoff, who ran a blog called Sweet Land of Liberty, in which he also made the left-wing case against abortion.
Right.
But it was rare. But it surprised quite a lot of people to understand that it's a more nuanced subject than they think.
Of course it is.
It's always puzzled me that it's such a big feminist thing. Because certainly as my memory in the 1960s, when the abortion laws in this country were being liberalised, abortion was not made legal in this country in 67. It was already legal.
Yeah.
It was made more legal. But I seem to remember the people who were most relieved when that went through were irresponsible men.
Yes.
Who always seem to me to be the biggest beneficiaries for me.
Well, like all things, it's become an hysterical argument now, hasn't it? And you cannot have a sort of reasoned argument with almost anybody about it. You know, the mantra that America has banned abortion is not true.
Well, no, it's not true.
The mantra that, you know, certain states have banned abortion is also not true. And in fact, many of the states will have abortion laws like most of Europe, aside from Britain and the Netherlands, which have got particularly liberal abortion
rules. Yeah, I think some of them will make it pretty much impossible. But it's here's the point. I mean, what do you?
They'll make some kinds of abortion impossible. They won't make all abortion impossible.
But the thing isn't it something which really ought to be discussed rationally rather than emotionally if we want to have the
right. Well, can anything be discussed rationally anymore?
It can be.
Can it?
That was the point of. The other point of my putting the stuff out. Okay, all you people who say that I'm a hateful reactionary
devil incarnate
who wants to trample on the rights of women. Here they are confronted with somebody who's the opposite of what they think I am, saying pretty much the same as I do, that there's something seriously worrying about taking the life of an unborn baby.
Yes.
And that there ought to be something seriously worrying about it, and you don't have to be a reactionary monster to believe this.
Yes.
I think that might be the start of reasoned argument once people realise that.
Yes, but I suspect it would be up against such a wall of fug, for want of a better word. I mean, I was rather amused by Piers Morgan's observation at the weekend where he said, isn't it funny how everybody seems to have rediscovered the word woman?
Yeah.
Because,
I know where we're going.
Yeah, because the left...
Starmerland here.
Well, Starmerland, who is, you know, but all... And many of the people who are championing, you know, whatever the opposite is to what happened at the Supreme Court, last week couldn't tell you what a woman was.
You're demanding consistency.
Yes, I know.
In your opponents.
I shouldn't.
Which
is shocking.
Will only get you into the most terrible trouble.
As ever, Peter, great to see you. Thank you very much indeed. Peter Hitchens, every Sunday in the Mail on Sunday. Although now, and occasionally during the week as well. In fact, indeed, we didn't get to that great piece you wrote. We'll do that perhaps next time. We'll take some calls. This is Talk TV. Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk TV. We've got lots of great tweets coming. I must read a few of them to you before we don't get too far past them. Angela says this: we sold a car to a prince from Tanzania, or so he said. He turned up with £20,000 in a briefcase. Us and our neighbour went to the bank with him, as we did think it was dodgy. The car was shipped out to Africa. Well, there you go. And Jenny in Milton Keynes says, yes, dodgy money, if in large cash amounts, money laundering, why not a cheque? The Prince's Trust shouldn't have accepted cash without evidence of provenance, proceeds of crime acts, and amends apply. Well, you would think so, because here's the problem. If, in fact, you try to apply for a mortgage these days, there are money laundering rules which say if you can't account for every single penny of where your deposit came from, for example, if your mother-in-law decided to give you some money, or if your brother decided to lend you some money, or you borrowed some money from somebody else, they need to know that it's in your bank account for a long enough period so that you cannot be accused of money laundering. But bring in €1 million in cash from Qatar and just hand it over to the heir to the throne, that's fine. Not a problem. Let's talk to Mark Bukowski, who's a branded PR expert, because talking of bags of money, there was a big festival at the weekend known as Glastonbury, and everybody watched it, supposedly. Some people loved it, some people didn't, but there were some interesting matters arising, and we thought we'd get Mark on to talk about it. Mark, very good morning to you, I should say.
Hi, Mike.
Were you glued to the television all weekend?
I dipped in and out for acts. These days, you've heard of FOMO, haven't you, Mike?
I have.
Fear of missing out.
Yes.
I've got JOMO, joy of missing out.
Well, that's as a result of your great wisdom and age, I suspect.
Well, I guess I've been to Glastonbury a few times working it. So I think the experience, if you are, should we say, without the necessary passes, can not be altogether joyous.
No, I mean, I've always said, I've never been to it, but I went once, interviewed Steve Lillywhite, who has only been to Glastonbury once, and that was to produce U2's set. And he told me that he was flown in a helicopter, spent the night with what's the name's father, Keith, can't remember his name, and I think they're doing all sorts of things, and then they helicoptered back out in the middle of the night, 5 o'clock in the morning. And I thought, that's about the only way I would ever go.
Well, that's the way to do it. The thing about the BBC is they just cover the main stages. And actually, in truth, Glastonbury is an incredible experience, particularly if you're young. You make amazing memories. But it's full of really amazing stages, amazing events, which can't really be shown on the TV. Mm. A bit like Paul McCartney's praise of Johnny Depp.
I mean, yes.
It's just showing the acts. And any time there's anything political, and it is very political, many people want to make a point, it's sort of edited out. Even the infamous Little Amal, this enormous puppet that's been walking across the world. I mean, the sort of journalism around it was shocking, really, to explain, you know, what it's been doing and what it's doing. Right. It was more or less something that you would expect from play schools circa 1976. But, you never, on the TV, you never truly get the depth and enormity and the incredible sort of force of humanity that descend on it and have a great time.
Although Richard Bacon didn't quite see it like that. I don't know if you saw his tweet at the weekend, where he said, nobody tells you how terrible Glastonbury actually is. It looks great on TV. When you get there, it's ugly, it's ghastly, there's too many people, and it's all full of old white people.
I mean, it is. It's a middle-class festival. No matter if Kendrick Lamar making incredible statements, you know, you struggle to find many people of ethnic diversity, you know, I think they say. And God forbid it rains. I mean, in 1997, I was working it, and it was an experience one could own. The mud emanated from all sorts of places, mixed up with bodily feces. It was just terrible.
I remember that. I remember running those pictures in the papers. It was ghastly, wasn't it?
It was like Passchendaele. Mm. You know, I mean, it's just with sand. Yeah.
With Passchendaele with people from Putney. Can't imagine anything worse. But that was the thing.
People queue up for, everything, and you know, it is, and you know, I'd hate to see the site today because it'll just reminisce of a huge battlefield. It'll be ugly, and poor people take weeks and weeks and weeks to clean up.
Yeah.
So anybody with those sort of values that you know, of Greta Thunberg, probably don't preach them when they're leaving their tents behind.
Well, I'm told this season as well that all the electric vehicles were being charged by diesel generators, which of course is now par for the course. So, you know, so much for your carbon footprint. But the one thing I did want to ask you about was what your theory is, because everybody's got a theory on what happened to Paul McCartney's sort of playback set, because the iPlayer didn't have it until about 24 hours later. My contention is that there was some kind of row going on, because they don't normally take that long to turn it around. First of all, they didn't put it out live, because perhaps they feared that it wouldn't be as good as they wanted it to be or something. But I know that some bands and some artists will demand to see what you're putting out before you put it out. And I wonder whether, having done that sort of incredible video, AI kind of duet with John Lennon, somebody in Paul McCartney's management went, this is a bit, you know, this is worth quite a few quid. Are you sure you wanted to put it out free on the BBC iPlayer?
I mean, if you think of Diana Ross's set, if you're watching Diana Ross, there was no close-ups of her. I mean, there are a lot of demands placed on artists. And yes, when you're an icon like McCartney, you can call the shots. So I dare say that it was poured over, both technically and rights issues. Apple are an incredibly powerful organization, you know, who preside over some of the richest IP known to man.
Yeah.
But, you know, everybody's very careful about their image now. Everybody's very, very careful about their image and how it was projected. And I think if you looked at certain algorithms in Twitter and social media today, people were just saying that perhaps Paul McCartney, although he had his energy and incredible stamina and, you know, he gave it all, you know, his voice isn't what it was.
No,
I saw McCartney, nor is Diana. But these are spectacles. You have to deliver. And you have to deliver on the hype. And for anybody who was there, it was probably a fantastic experience.
Oh, I think so.
Because,
I mean, I think 2.5 hours.
The sound is much better. Is much better live than obviously can be transmitted by the BBC.
Yeah, and also, 2.5 hours of a live show is a long time to be standing in front of a stage, watching every single second of it without being occasionally distracted. And some of the quieter moments, I didn't watch all of it, like you, but some of the quieter moments, you probably would have been standing there thinking, I've been here for 3 days and, you know, I've taken too many drugs and, you know, I'm not really sure what's going on, but I'm just going to stay here, but I can't really do anything. And that's kind of what a lot of them look like.
Well, I mean, people get their kicks in whichever way they want to do. Hallucinogenics.
Hey, listen,
I'm not
being critical. I'm just saying that's what it looked like.
No. Well, I'm sure. I mean, you've got to be there, really, to get the vibe, you know. And, of course, there are certain people who are lost in Glastonbury trance, as we call it.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, I think it's remarkable that a man in his 80th year, his ninth decade, can actually do what he's doing.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
It is phenomenal. But then again, how does it project after the event? Mm. Not to the people. That's why lots of people. I think Live Aid, the first Live Aid back in 86, whenever it was, many of that footage wasn't released for years.
Right.
And some of that footage has never been released.
Right.
Because people do it for that moment, for that crowd. They don't expect it to be poured over for decades. Because you see a band and they're actually on fire one night, you go to see them in another town and another night, and it's a really dull performance.
No, you're absolutely right. And I'm certainly not, I'm not being critical of, I'm being critical really of the BBC for having, you know, hundreds of people down there and not turning it around quicker than they did, because it seems to me that that was their job, and they failed.
Glitches there were, and I think that is due to the fact that possibly they don't have as many people. The broadcasting of that event is a huge undertaking. I'm not talking about the thousands of liggers with various wristbands on that perhaps don't deserve to be there, friends and friends of sort of BBC people who are there.
Right.
But it is a remarkable event to cover off because it is so vast. As I said previously, you know, curation is only left to the 4 or 5 main stages. And I think that some of the presenters this year lacked some of the sort of class of someone like Mark Ratcliffe, and I know about Martin Laverne, her death of her mother. But, I mean, someone like Joe Wiley really does root it. And the Jack Saunders guy seems to be, you know, up and coming and pretty good. But to make it interesting. Yeah, but with red hair. You know, it's tough. It's a tough gig because people don't do live anymore.
Yeah.
The BBC thrived on it on a Saturday night. They rather not do it now, and it's easier to do as live.
Yes, which is a pity, really. But listen, Mark, as ever, thank you very much indeed. Mark Bukowski there, brand and PR expert on the weekend of Glastonbury. Thank God it's over, I think is what I can say. But if you liked it, good luck to you. I just think the BBC waste even more money than they should. This is Talk TV.
Veggie Talk, Plain Talk, Unrivaled Talk, Mike Graham. The only radio show you can count on for a proper serving of good old-fashioned common sense. In search of the perfect debate.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham.
See it, hear it, think it. Talk Radio and Talk TV.
Good afternoon and welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk TV, the home of common sense, the place where, of course, you come not only for infotainment, but you come for entertainment and you come for the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth. We've already made our way into the afternoon. It's 5 past midday already on day one. Luckily, nobody else has gone on strike yet, just the barristers today. So I'm afraid if you're up for common assault, they won't be hearing the case. So you can rest easy until the next time. But apparently they're going to be striking every week. One extra day, so 2 days next week, 3 days a week after that, 4 days a week after that, and then 5 days a week after that. I just had Jenny on, who was very irate because her husband's a barrister. She said, I've got it completely wrong, and I should be supporting them. Well, I don't support strikes, generally speaking. I don't support teachers' strikes either. They're talking about doing that. And coming up in this hour, we're going to be talking to Molly Kingsley and Liz Cole for Us For Them, who have been, of course, campaigning for children in our schools because nobody else has been. We've got kids who basically have not been to school for about 2 years. They're back now, but they are missing a part of their education, missing a part of their socialisation, missing a part of the life that they should have had. And there's still plenty of people who are telling me that they see their children have changed and they haven't changed back yet to normal. So we'll talk about that coming up. We'll also take more of your calls. We'll also talk to Simon Calder because there is a bit more travel chaos on the way. People have been flying into Manchester Airport today saying they've been waiting 2 hours to get through customs and immigration. British Airways are going to be announcing their strike dates as well, which I'm not looking forward to because I'm supposed to be going on holiday for the first time in 3 years with British Airways, believe it or not. Anyway, never mind all that. We are here. This is the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. It's time to say hello to Molly and Liz. Hi.
Hi. Hi, Mike.
Welcome to the Independent Republic. Thanks for coming in. You guys are a bit busy at the moment, I hear.
A little bit busy, yes.
So yeah. You've got a new book out. I've got The Children's Inquiry, is what it's called. I think we might have a little picture of what it looks like. So, Molly, tell us about The Children's Inquiry. Tell us what it's about and when it's coming out.
Yeah, of course. So it's coming out on Thursday, which is very exciting. And really what it is our attempt to make sure that what we have seen and learnt and been told in the 2 years since we co-founded Us For Them becomes a matter of public record. So, you know, I think as you just said, Mike, in your introduction, you know, the kids have been treated pretty appallingly and to an extent, actually, it's still ongoing. And it's really our attempt to make sure that we can't just brush over what happened to them.
Is it still ongoing, Liz? I mean, my kids have always been sort of slightly rebellious, funnily enough. But I don't think they're being forced to do anything at the moment, are they?
No, I think, you know, many of the restrictions have now eased off. Mm. But I think that doesn't mean to say that the impacts of this last 2 years have dissipated. And I think we're now seeing, unfortunately, the effects all too clearly on, you know, children's mental health, on their physical health, and obviously on their education as well. So, you know, we're really, really keen that this book, as Molly said, puts on the record just how severe some of these impacts have been. And there does seem to be a desire from many people to kind of revise and rewrite history as if none of this ever happened.
Well, there is a bit of that, isn't there, going on? Because when you'd see the government ministers variously saying things like, well, you know, maybe we shouldn't have shut the borders, you know, well, maybe we shouldn't have shut the schools, you know, meh. And it's all like as if it wasn't massively disruptive to everybody's lives. I mean, I still remember the first lockdown where the first 8 weeks I was working in London and my kids live in Sussex. I didn't see them because we all kind of took a collective decision as a family that if I was working in London, which might have been, you know, the hotbed of some horrible, ghastly new disease which was going to make people drop down dead in the street, maybe I shouldn't go to Sussex and take it with me. And I also thought at one point, maybe I won't be able to get back. Maybe there'll be a roadblock. I mean, it was insane, wasn't it?
It was very extreme. And I think what we saw during the pandemic was that kids were totally, I mean, it wasn't even sidelined. They just weren't considered in decisions. And I think when we talk about it being ongoing, all of those weaknesses are still there. Like nothing has been corrected. And, you know, actually you mentioned the strikes, you know, we're about to go into a situation where perhaps we've certainly got rail strikes. We might have all kinds of other strikes. And again, it will be the kids that lose out because they don't have a voice. They've got no one representing their interests.
That's right. Well, we've had this week or last week, I think, with the rail strikes, children supposedly doing A-levels, doing other GCSEs, not being able to get on trains to get to school. I mean, it's incredible, isn't it?
It is incredible, and I think it really characterises what's happened throughout the pandemic, whereby adults couldn't get together to sort out their differences and actually put children at the top of the agenda. And I think this is another example of that, because really our children should be the priority in society.
Yeah.
And we have to try to start putting them first and, you know, put this sort of bickering to one side, I think.
And when you formed Us For Them, Molly, tell us a bit about how that happened and how you kind of came to be the campaigners for this outfit.
We met on Twitter.
Twitter actually was quite a place in them. If it hadn't been for Twitter, I wonder actually what it would have been like.
Well, it's amazing because all these people had all these new Twitter friends, and actually, you know, as the pandemic sort of ceased and died down, we actually got to meet them, including people like you, and it's been so, you know, it's, but yeah, we met, both just felt, and with our third co-founder Christine Brett as well, we felt very strongly that kids just hadn't been considered in this decision making. So it was in a sort of build up. It was around 6 weeks into the first school closures, and we just got talking in the comments to a post on Twitter and decided, I think I've still got the text from Liz actually, should we launch a campaign?
Yeah
why not? How hard can that be? Right. And obviously we didn't.
I mean, did
really
you
know.
Find Liz that there were some parents who weren't with you? Because I know that once the school started to go back and people were asked to wear masks and things, I mean, I was astonished to see that a lot of parents were telling me that they'd go to the school and there'd be parents outside wearing masks and sort of staring at people who weren't wearing them, looking at kids who weren't wearing them. And it was quite a divisive time, wasn't it?
It was very divisive, and certainly for quite a long time we were subject to quite a lot of criticism, honestly, for our stance. But as time's gone by, I think, you know, more and more people have recognised just how detrimental the school closures in particular and other measures have been. But it was very difficult to be the ones that were sticking your head on the above the parapet.
Well, I think we all hear it when we were Talk Radio, Julia and myself and others, you know, all the things that we asked about turn out that we should have been asking about them, and most of the things that we said weren't necessary turn out not to have been necessary. And yet we're supposed to just now go, oh well, let's just carry on then, let's just get on with it.
I mean, I think that's exactly right, and I think particularly with the kids, you know, we keep using this phrase, it was not only predictable, it was predicted.
Yeah.
And you know, it's great that Nadim has come on, you know, apologised for that, but actually what does that mean? You know, what's an apology without any promise that they wouldn't do it again? It doesn't mean much. No. So
what's the book actually for in your view? You know, you've decided to write a book, you obviously have to think about how to structure it and all of that, so tell us a bit about that.
I mean, I think it's twofold. I think the first is, as I said, to set out what we've seen and learned, and also actually our perception of the really quite serious errors in policy making and safeguarding which has led to these impacts on kids. And I think stemming from that, the second thing, which is really important, is to try and set out a bit of a vision of how we might do children better in politics.
Right. Because so many schools have so many different outcomes as well, don't they? And I think a lot of people would say probably that schools with you know, kids from more underprivileged backgrounds have probably done worse, because, you know, it's all right if you're living in a nice little, you know, mansion in Putney and you're working from home with your kids in the garden and running around and they've all got their little iPads, but not if you're living in some council estate, you know, in I don't know, Streatham.
Yeah, and I think it was a huge amount of inequity that we saw throughout the pandemic, particularly during the period of, you know, so-called remote learning, which for many children was anything but learning. You know, not only could many children not access it, but some children didn't have access to the technology. Right. And even where you did have access to that technology, that is not the way that children actually learn. So it was an incredibly stressful period for many children and families.
Well, an awful lot of kids as well, if you were, say, at primary school, you know, you've only been around for 6 or 7 years, and two of those years, you've basically done nothing.
Well, I think that's exactly right. And actually, we were lucky. So my kids were at primary school. They were very young, the little one, when lockdown began. And actually, you know, we were the lucky ones, and we had a garden and they had access to a computer. It was a disaster, Mike, an absolute disaster. And it was so bad. The little one was four, and it was so destructive, actually, and so negative that we just aborted it after a few weeks. We just thought, this is a really unpleasant experiment and not something we should be doing with. And actually, you know, the older one, who was, what, 6, 7 at the time, was expected to sit in front of his computer for hours. And these were the lucky kids. And even, I would say, for those children, it was not a positive experience.
No, because also most parents, even the most enlightened, are not that good at looking after your children, you know, if they should be at school 24/7. You can't do it, can you? Because presumably you also have to do work as well if you're a working mother or a working father.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the strain on many families was immense. So that whole domestic environment became fraught for so many people. Right. You know, but I think that actually it's something that we don't want to see this repeated. And I think, again, that's one of the objectives of writing this book, is we don't necessarily see sufficient enough acknowledgement that this was a disaster and it cannot be repeated. Yes. That actually schools shouldn't have closed and they shouldn't close again. You know, they should be treated as the essential infrastructure, which actually they are.
Yeah. And I will say as well, they shouldn't be penalised for being taken out of school, or they have, you know, net zero tolerance on kids not appearing for school. And I said to my kids, I said, well, like, you can tell them from me, you know, when it gets up to the number of days you didn't go in because they told you not to come in, then we can have that conversation. But tell us a bit about writing a book together, because that's never easy. I mean, how did you work out who did what?
I think we got less organised as it went on, didn't we? So we started with a plan, and then the plan fell apart as we got nearer and nearer.
So you didn't do one chapter each or something like that?
Well, actually, we did one chapter like that, and it was a disaster, wasn't it? So then we just sort of went on for 2 weeks on one.
Okay.
So no, it was genuinely 50-50, wasn't it? And we sort of did 1,000 words and 1,000 words and 1,000 words. And
are you hoping to present this to, like, the inquiry whenever it does finally come? I'm pretty sure Boris Johnson would rather it didn't ever come. He would just keep going around the world until, you know, he's finally, you know, got nowhere else left to go. But when is the inquiry? Do you know?
Oh, half a decade away. I mean, they're very quiet. I think the earliest I'd heard was 2025. So, I mean, useless.
That's
for children.
Ridiculous.
And even if they prioritise kids, I'd heard a rumour that we're going to put kids to the front, which is fantastic. But it's going to be too late for this cohort of kids. So, no, we're going to send a copy to Lady Hallett and her legal team.
Good.
Yep.
All right. Well, we'll do everything we can to publicise it. Coming out on Thursday, did you say?
Thursday, yeah, the 30th of June.
Great. Well, congratulations.
Oh,
you're now
so
officially
much.
Authors as well.
Yeah.
So you can claim that. Well done. So, Molly Kingsley, Liz Cole, Us For Them. The book's called The Children's Inquiry, How the State and Society Failed the Young During the Pandemic. It will be available soon. We'll be doing lots on it, I'm sure, as time goes on. Thanks, guys, for coming in. Coming up, we're going to talk to Simon Calder. Apparently, people are fighting at the airports now. Great, isn't it? This is Talk TV.
Talk Radio. Across the UK. Online. On DAB. And on your smart speaker. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham. On Talk Radio.
If you enjoyed that, be sure to catch the whole show 10 to 1 Monday to Friday on Talk Radio via DAB online or via the Talk Radio app. And if you have an opinion on the stories we cover, we'd love to hear from you. Call us on 0344 499 1000 or tweet at Talk Radio during the show to have your say.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.